The concept of decadence lies right at the core of our theoretical approach, not just to the perspective for an end to capitalism, but indeed to understanding the whole sweep of human history and its succession of different social forms from the emergence of mankind right up to the present day. Our readers may have noticed that for some time now, in the International Review, we've undertaken a series of articles to explain this idea more fully than perhaps we have done in the past, and to update some of our own thinking on the subject, especially as it can be found in the pamphlet on the decadence of capitalism, which was one of the first publications that the ICC produced. So it seemed a good idea to podcast a discussion on the series, to give some idea to the background of our own debates on the subject, which have been extensive over the 30-odd years that the ICC has existed. And we hope you'll find it interesting.
No, my first idea was to talk about the Reconstruction boom, because that's the one I was keen on, but you seemed a bit bored with that, so I thought...
Well, there's a lot of... It could get into a lot of facts and arguments about facts and figures. I don't know. But also, I think it has to be put in a more global context.
The
whole discussion about the post-war boom was a discussion about the decadence, apparently. You know, and unless you've got the general idea of decadence, the discussion about the post-war boom maybe find it a bit abstruse. I don't know.
Yeah, that may well be true. But that was one of the things about the whole post-war boom discussion that I thought was positive, was that we actually ended up having to go much further afield than that.
Yeah.
In fact, any theory that you have about that period has to be able to take into account the previous period, and also then it has to take you up to now. So, you know, I'm quite happy to start off talking about decadence as a whole. Why not? And especially since we're in the middle of a series on decadence in the International Review. And I was thinking one way we could start that off was, why are we producing this series in the first place? We've got a pamphlet on decadence. If you look through the review over the last 30-odd years, it's frightening sometimes. There just seem to be endless polemics about
decadence. Yeah.
What have we got to say about it that's different, if anything?
Yeah. Well, if you recall, we were trying to... We were having our discussion about the flaws of the decadence pamphlet, and particularly on the question of the post-war boom. And there was an idea that we needed a general, a more theoretical work, but we also needed a popular pamphlet. I remember Conrad saying, yes, we need someone who's good at vulgarising. So I was given the job of producing a vulgar pamphlet explaining decadence. It was said in French, maybe it doesn't have quite the same connotation. So I sort of agreed. As often happens, short, easy to understand pamphlet became a bit of a monster, because I looked at the decadence pamphlet. There's no point just trying to edit it, because it's a historic document. It's better that we keep that pamphlet. I mean, it could just be, to write a new introduction and so on. But it kind of, but thinking about it, particularly with all of the difficulties that the current generation seems to have with decadence, I think that's one of the main reasons why we find ourselves endlessly polemicising on this question. Because if you go back to the beginning of the 70s, when we were formed, for a lot of us, the concept of decadence within a general framework of historical materialism was a big breakthrough in understanding. A lot of us come from anarchism, and we were not satisfied with the theoretical approach of anarchism, or Paul Cardin's idea about, you know, that capitalism has overcome its crisis and all that. And I remember first coming across internationalism, in particular in relation to the sort of national conflicts that were going on at the time, which was a big issue for me at the time. And I was just completely bowled over by the coherence of it, by the global and historical perspective. This is actually giving me an understanding of what's happening, putting it into a general context. And it fell into place, this sort of idea sort of did win out for a lot of the new elements that were appearing at the time. I remember revolutionary perspectives sort of resisted for a little bit, and then they said, well, maybe decadence started in 1929, and then they agreed, basically, although they had a different economic explanation, but they basically understood, in order to understand the capitalist world today, you have to see it in this general context. Whereas today, you know, we've been around for a long time putting forward this conception, and a large, and you know, for us, you know, capitalism is not only decadent, but it's even more decadent than it was, obviously. And yet there is this tremendous resistance to the whole idea amongst, you know, a lot of the new generation who are influenced by, again, by anarchism and various other ideas as well that are floating about. And so, again, it seemed necessary to go back to the basics of what did Marx say and what did, you know, to reconstruct a history, if you like, of the concept within the workers' movement and why it was so central and then why it's not our invention. I mean, it's not something we haven't said before, but I think it was important to go back and sort of say, well, this is what Marx said about it and Engels, and then you know, so these were the debates in the Second International when the revisionists appeared, what Luxembourg said. This is how it was understood when the First World War broke out and so on. So that's how the series kind of developed, really, it became historical.
Mm. Well, I know what you mean about discovering the decadence pamphlet, because that was the first thing of the ICCs that I read. I was in a small provincial town and got a letter from a mate who'd been to one of the first public meetings of World Revolution and wrote to me and said, look, I've just met these guys, you might find them interesting, send me some money, I'll send you their press. I sent him some money, never expecting to see anything come back. And I got the Decadence pamphlet, and I think it was number 2 of WR or something like that. And it was the same for me, but from a different angle, because I remember it was very emotive for me when I was in my teens and arguing with my father about the state of the world. And his answer was always, but you've no idea, you know, you didn't see the 1930s, you didn't see the war. How could you possibly say the world's in a bad way now? It's so much better than it used to be. This is in the end of the 60s. And the Decadence pamphlet put that all into perspective, and for me, in a sense, in particular, the whole issue of the Reconstruction period, in a sense, you realised, or I came to the conclusion anyway, that, okay, so the Reconstruction period of the 50s and 60s looks much better than the 30s, but it was paid for with 40 million dead. If that's the price, that puts a very different angle on it. I think one of the things that people who put the whole notion into question have a problem with is that you have to explain World War One. For me, World War One is one of the crucial things. And nobody had ever seen a war like this before. It was earth-shattering. It divided the history into before World War One and after World War One. And unless you have some really solid explanation of why that happened, then I think, you know, any theoretical approach has a big issue. But the question that I wanted to ask you is, you know, why? You know, why is it that younger people than us have so much difficulty with this idea?
Well, I think
it's a sort of a revelation to us. Why does this not happen now?
New generation. I mean, there's a different issue. Why? There's one aspect of why the anarchism is so attractive to so many of the new generation. And anarchism has a lot of difficulties with the idea of, it's not so much a decadence in some ways, it's ascendancy. They have the problem with the idea that capitalism actually was once had a progressive stage, and that at that time maybe it was permissible to engage in trade union work, not so much, but parliament, you know, for building, working in parliament, supporting certain national struggles. For them, you know, Marx was just wrong about this, and Bakunin was right, or it may not be as crude as that, but Marx was very questionable in all this. And of course, you can find elements in what Marx and Engels said on these questions, which is questionable. You know, some of the stuff that they said about the national question, you know, it's a bit embarrassing today. But that's not the issue. The issue is their general approach, and that's what they have a lot of problem with, that idea that there was once a phase in which capitalism could be seen to be playing a progressive role in relation to the previous system. That's one thing. I think another thing is that a lot of these comrades have kind of been born in the, not the post-war boom that we came out of, but the boom of the sort of even more sort of fake boom of the 90s, where everything seemed to be, you know, consumerism was running rampant, and you know, the whole debt thing was really, really taking off. And again, to see that the system had fundamental economic barriers to it seemed difficult to grasp. I think now, you know, if people are beginning to think about it, they're beginning to question it. Well, comrades just told me to read the new text by Alf Haven on the crisis, which seems to say, oh, well, this is going to be there'll be another upswing after this. And I won't say too much about it because I haven't read it yet. But there's still a resistance. I think there's also another element which is kind of takes you to some extent onto the sort of psychological level, which is that there's a resistance to the concept of mortality, to the idea that we really are at the end of the system, and more people, I think, feel that. If you look at the economic situation now and the ecological situation and so on, people are thinking this civilization really on its last legs, and it's not hard to convince people of that, to see it. And at the same time, there's a resistance to accepting the implications of that. Because a lot of people would say, well, fuck it, what's the point? I'll just, you know, I'll just live my life or you know, while I'm here, but there's no point thinking about the future because there isn't one. And that idea that there's no future at all, period, can be very depressing. Mm. So I think people have a resistance to the idea of, you know, the system is on the verge of death, as it were, and just as the individual kind of represses the idea of their own mortality, I think there's that element in it as well.
Mm. All the more so because it's so difficult to see what you can do about it. Mm. If you're confronted with a situation which is dire, but you can actually see a way out, then you'll have enough people who are galvanized into action to actually go and do something about it. I was just thinking, we had a discussion on perspective, you know, the perspectives of capitalism recently. I think it came out of a sort of a rather poor turn of phrase in an article in RI or something like that. And I remember we had at one point talked about capitalism having perspectives, even in decadence. You know, if you think about World War II, for example. I mean, World War II was incredibly dire. You think about how people felt at the end of the 30s with the rise of fascism, the rise of Nazism. They could see the war coming, and they'd already been through World War I. I know my grandfather, for example, was in both wars, so you had a generation which had been through the most appalling bloodletting that humanity had ever seen. Seeing a new one coming up, with new weapons, you know, far, far worse. What people say about the atomic bomb today, you know, people back then were saying about mass air fleets and gas. And everyone was expecting that there'd be German bombers bombing, gassing London, basically. But there was a perspective that capitalism, the democratic states offered the perspective of the New Deal, of democracy, the struggle for democracy, and afterwards there will be a new world, a world fit for heroes. We'd already heard that after World War I, but you know, people are ready to give it another try. And so even in the war, even in the most terrible moments, people thought, well, there is a perspective. But now we've been through, how many years it is, 50-odd years since World War II. And again, I remember one of my, I think for our generation also as a whole, the Vietnam War was very formative, very, it destroyed a lot of illusions in democracy for our generation. Because you had the biggest democracy in the world pounding a small third world country into rubble. For what? Certainly not to defend democracy, because we could, and all our democratic governments, all the hope that was given to the generation at the end of World War II, that we were going to have a national health service, that this would look after people. And now we're being told, no, this is the nanny state. You know, we've looked after you long enough. We can't afford it anyway. So I can't help thinking that makes a big difference as well. I mean, you look at, for example, the big difference between what happened in Egypt and Tunisia recently and what's happening in Spain is that in Egypt and Tunisia, people still had the illusion, less now, I imagine, that you could have a revolt, that you could get rid of Mubarak, and we'll have democracy. Mm. Well, in Spain, they've got democracy. Not only have they got democracy, they've got a socialist government.
Yeah.
And they're still in shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which puts a whole different view, a whole different perspective on things. The problem is, what do you do about it?
That's why a lot of the movements today, as we were saying yesterday, it's just the opportunity to discuss about it, for people to come together and talk. But it's impossible to have a clear view what to do about it for the majority of people, because it's so distant. This society and a different society, the leap seems gigantic. And yes, even if they thought about the possibility of a new society. But the very fact of people coming together and saying, look, this, things aren't working. That was one of the signs that the occupation of capitalism isn't working.
Mm.
I mean, clearly the system isn't working. So, you know, we've had the whole thing, well, communism didn't work. That was the sort of basis for this last stage of sort of propaganda, that capitalism was the answer to everything. And now it's really that whole period is finished, you know, the period from the, you know, through the 90s and so on, that capitalism could kind of claim that it had conquered the world, and it's brought us to this, and people are saying, well, that didn't work either. So they haven't yet got an alternative, and you know, the alternatives that are put forward are very, very unclear, and very often it's because they lack that general, that theoretical framework to understand that, you know, capitalism is, and what, even to understand what capitalism is. I mean, that's huge confusion about the capitalism is the bankers, or it's capitalism is, you know, the right-wing politicians or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But to understand that this is a civilization, it's a social relation that, you know, has a whole history behind it, I think that is going to dawn, and it's going to emerge from a lot of those discussions. But I think that's why we've got a particular role to play in trying to put that perspective.
Mm. Well, there's another aspect which comes up sometimes, is that not directly relevant perhaps, but when people say, you know, you say capitalism is decadent, capitalism is going to collapse, that means we're automatically going to have communism.
Yeah.
And that's often something we're criticised for, because, of course, we don't mean that. You know, we've always been very clear about that, just as Marx was clear about it in the manifesto. You know, the choice at the, when you come to the end of any society, is a revolution or the common ruin of the contending classes. And that's what we're faced with. So exactly what form the common ruin would take, it's difficult to say. And I think another thing also that we're very, to be honest, I think we're confused about it, is I tend to talk about the catastrophic collapse of capitalism. Well, I don't think anybody quite knows exactly what that means. You know, I know for me, when I hear the word catastrophe, I think, you know, earthquakes, something sudden.
Mm.
I don't think the collapse of capitalism, it won't be sudden. It will be long drawn out and painful, because the crisis we have now is not going to go away. It's not going to be a new cycle of accumulation, as some people put it. But it's not just going to disintegrate either into nothing. It's going to, it'll be a catastrophe, but it'll be a long catastrophe.
Well, that's one of the things that's changed in our vision, if you like, since the 70s and 80s, where we were focused very much with justification, I think, on the possibility of the Third World War.
Yes, yes.
But that was a real threat, a real danger. And we said, if the working class doesn't overthrow capitalism, that's the inevitable. And that's, if you like, we'd grown up with that whole perspective from our political forebears in the 30s and so on, that it was going to be world war or world revolution. And what's changed in the last few decades is the understanding that it may not be a world war. It may not be. It could be another, as you say, slower form of a series of catastrophes, which would be a combination of wars, ecological breakdown, economic disaster, and so on. Which is no more reassuring, obviously. And the danger is that it reaches, that this process reaches a point where the working class is really not able to respond to it. That's the whole danger of the phase that we're in now. I think what we always have understood is that the collapse of capitalism isn't a purely economic collapse. Mm-hmm. I mean, Rosa Luxemburg has always been accused of having this automatic view of socialism coming out of the collapse of capitalism, always insisted that the sort of economic collapse was a kind of theoretical possibility. But long before that, the economic and political factors would and military factors would be inserted into the situation, and it would go one way or the other, but it wouldn't just be a pure economic blocking up of the system. And no doubt she would have been very surprised by how, as with all the revolutions, whatever their economic analysis, at the time of the First World War, how long the system has managed to stagger on. Well, theoretically, that idea was entertained. For Engels, for example, said, we could imagine that this decaying system carrying on for a long time, perhaps not 100 years, but he talked about decades and so on. A system in decay, but still carrying on. And that's what we've had. And as we've had it, the dangers of the continuation system have actually grown, haven't become less, despite all the superficial benefits. I mean, if you just take into consideration the ecological side of things. I mean, if the working class had been able to make the revolution in 1917, the world ecologically was completely different. Capitalism had polluted and destroyed to some extent, but nothing like on the scale that you've had after the 100 years of this perpetuation of the system. Now, if the working class makes a revolution, the ecological question will be absolutely central to the whole process of transforming the planet. We're absolutely at the heart of the communist program, which, in the past, people hardly even gave it much consideration, which was a weakness, but it was based on objective reality that it wasn't this gigantic problem that had developed through the sheer perpetuation of the system. And I think that that's an element which proves, which adds further weight to the idea the system is past its sell my day, that it's gone on far too long for the safety of humanity.
Well, thinking about the longevity of decadent societies reminds me that the great Edward Gibbon's book on the decline and fall of the Roman Empire covers a period of 1,300 years. Maybe got a fair time to go. So, of course, the Roman Empire was a very different economic system. The whole point about capitalism is how dynamic it is, in ascendancy and unfortunately also in decadence.
Yes.
And I think on the ecological aspect of it, you're absolutely right. And there's a book I'd like to do a review of at some point, the When a Billion Chinese Jump.
Yes, I've heard of that.
Well worth a read, and it's absolutely frightening because China, they do everything on a much bigger scale than anywhere else. Now, if you're European, you're used to thinking that America is just everything on a bigger scale. China is like everything on a bigger scale than America. It's enormous, and the ecological catastrophe is just almost indescribable, really. But the other thing about it, of course, as you think about it, is that the whole let's suppose that capitalism worked, went on working, it obviously can't, because capitalism knows no limits. It must constantly go on producing more, which means absorbing more raw materials and so on and so on. And we do actually live on a round planet. It's not an endlessly continuous flat planet. So at some point or another, you're going to run out of whatever. So you've got to have a system which is capable of living on a single planet or going into outer space, but that's another one. We'll leave that aside for the moment. That's another question.
And this question about China, I mean, a lot of people say, look, it's China. How can you say the system is decadent? China is huge development. It's just like England was in the 1920s. Gigantic development. Surely this proves that capitalism is decadent. And at the same time, people accuse us of being
not decadent. Surely it proves that the system is not decadent.
People also accuse us of being productivists. They have this idea, we have this vision of, and even Marx is sometimes accused of having this productivist view, because, you know, he talks about a period of decadence or a period of social revolution is when the social relations of production are a fetter on the development of the productive forces. And so if the productive forces are developing, apparently, in China, then surely then it's not decadent. Well, I mean, this is, to me, a very crude interpretation of what Marx meant. In actual fact, it is in itself a productivist view, because it's seeing the development of production in purely capitalist terms. The development of productive forces comprises a much broader concept which encompasses the whole of human creativity, really. Once in a system which once gave a possibility for human creativity to develop, now more and more a blockage on it. The fact that more and more things are being made and factories are being built in China and so on isn't coterminous with what Marx meant by the development of the productive forces. In fact, it's an expression of a real blockage on the development of productive forces, understood in that deeper sense. Because productive forces, once they've reached the point where communism is possible, really means the development of human creativity for its own end, which is what communism is about. And what's happening in China is a complete negation of that, both on the ecological level, but also on the fact that you've had, in order to build this sort of monstrosity in China, you've had a kind of dismantling of some of the bastions of the working class in Western Europe and so on, where you've had a whole traditions of struggle and so on, which could have been an element in development of the class struggle, which have been sort of set back decades in some ways. You've got to relearn a lot of the traditions that have been lost because of this happening. So in terms of this does not represent any kind of human progress. It's a disaster in itself, just like the development of the Soviet Union in the 30s was a disaster. It was actually a preparation for another huge disaster, which was the Second World War. So the fact that factories are being built and mines are being excavated. So this is not what we mean by development of the productive forces.
And as you say, I was struck. There was a thread on the ICT forum a while back about. I think it was actually about our thesis on decomposition. And there was a lot of stuff about the historic course and so on. At one point, somebody said the working class has almost disappeared in Western Europe or Western And I think just said the working class has more or less disappeared. I thought it was a very parochial way of looking at things, because the working class hasn't disappeared, it's just moved.
Mm.
You know, the mass working class that used to be at Dagenham, where we used to go out and give out leaflets back in the old days, well, they're still there, it's just they're in China.
Mm.
And one town, I'm reading a book called Factory Girls at the moment about Chinese migrant workers, mostly women, and there's a town, I think it's Dongguan in China, where they make 2/3 of the world's shoes.
Mm.
A lot of them coming out of one factory which employs 70,000 people.
Mm.
So all this stuff about, always makes me laugh when we hear about we live in a post-industrial world. I mean, even in our generation, the number of industrial products that we're surrounded by compared to when we were kids is never been surrounded by so many industrial products.
Yeah.
And we're supposed to be living in a post-industrial world. But in fact, what's happened is they've just shipped everything out to China, India, and so on. And that's both the mass industrial production, but also the pollution that goes with it.
Mm.
All the greenery that you have in Europe and the United States, actually, it means that you ship the garbage out. You ship the most polluting industrial processes out to third world countries, and then you ship all the garbage that we produce out there as well to be recycled. Well, not even recycled in some cases. Well, another aspect, actually, that struck me very much, and that came out of the discussion on Reconstruction, and I think we've not paid enough attention to it, is the question of immigrant workers. Because one of the ways in which capitalism manages to increase its profitability is by using a workforce which comes from outside capitalism.
Mm.
Because it means that you don't have to pay for the education and the upkeep of the children, and you don't pay either, really, for the old people. And going back to reading Accumulation of Capital, in fact, Rosa Luxemburg highlights three things that capitalism needs from outside its own sphere: markets, raw materials, labour.
Mm.
We've never really paid much attention to the labour side of it, and yet when you look at the history of the world, especially since 1945, the migration is simply gigantic. Now, we're used to thinking of the migration to the United States in the 19th century. I'm thinking of this as the Great Migration. But in Europe, after 1945, in the 50s and 60s, there were 40 million people who left the countryside and moved to the towns. There was a quarter of the Greek workforce left Greece. And the same was true of Portugal. There were 9 million Italians from the Mezzogiorno who migrated to northern Italy and to the factory towns in Germany. And the same has happened in China. The migrant workforce is something like 130 million strong. Completely ignoring the workforce that already existed in factories and so on in China, in the urban areas, 130 million migrant workers. I mean, that's like, half the population of the United States.
Mm.
It's simply gigantic. And of course, what this is a workforce which came from the countryside, which was, to all intents and purposes, outside the capitalist system. And they've been able to make profit out of them because they just use them up and throw them away.
Mm.
And they haven't had to pay for the education. The capitalist class, the capitalist economic system, has not had to pay for the education.
Who don't like the conception of decadence? You say, well, what they often say is, well, capitalism is both progressive and reactionary always. It always has, which is partly true. I mean, when you look at the globalization, so-called, today, I mean, there are positive aspects of it in terms of the development of the worldwide consciousness of the working class exists on a global scale. Becomes more possible to understand that, but at the same time, in these developments, a huge amount is lost. As I was saying about the fact that we don't have in Britain the miners, the steel workers, the car workers, to a large extent, these industrial sectors who have been, you know, at the forefront of struggles in the past, and a lot of what they stood for has been lost. And you know, this is not a positive development. On the other hand, the fact that, you know, there are thousands of workers in China who are very combative and resisting, and that we also, that because of the development of the means of communication, we know much more quickly what's happening there. That's a positive element. And so there are always these elements, you know, where there's two sides of the coin. But I think what's specific to our view of things is to look at things in a, you know, in this sort of broad historical framework.
Mm.
And with China, for example, or you could also look at places like Dubai, which is a good example of development, which is, you know, to me a clear expression of a decaying society in every way. One of the things I discovered about Saudi Arabia is that with the development of the tourist industry in Saudi Arabia to cope with the pilgrims coming to Mecca, they're going to knock down large amounts of historical, priceless historical buildings, including the house where Muhammad lived, to make way for sort of hotels. And this is actually religiously justified by the Wahhabis, because you mustn't have any kind of idolatry even in relation to Muhammad. So the sort of conservative clerics, entirely at the service of the development of this, you know, modern tourist industry. You know, this is sort of concentrate everything that is rotten about the system. Yet there is development. Buildings are going up, impressive buildings, the tallest building in the world. And yet the context of it, in terms of the age in which we live, is so clearly an expression of a system which is really putrid.
Mm.
And again, this is not foreign to what Marx envisaged, the possibility of a development which was itself decay. You know, decadence, we've never, even in the first decadence pamphlet, which maybe, you know, there are things that, errors in it and so on, but it made it clear that when we talked about decadence, we did not mean the productive forces stop. Mm. Even in the capitalist sense, there is still a development. And clearly, within the last 100 years or so, there have been enormous developments at various levels. The question is that the conflict between the productive forces and the potential of productive forces and the actual relations of production becomes more and more destructive and catastrophic for humanity. Mm. That's the essence of our conception. It isn't that nothing is growing anymore. That's not the conception.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think that's one of the most important aspects. Marx did not talk about decadence, meaning to use the word. I mean, it certainly never meant for us that the economy comes to a stop, which was an idea that Trotsky defended in the 1930s, and with more justification, you could see why that would appear to be the case. And that's really to do with the specific nature of capitalism also, I think, that because capitalism as an economy depends on competition and technological development. Well, that's how capitalism works, contrary to feudalism or to any previous society, in fact. And it has to go on like that. And I'm always struck by the comparison, again, going back to Gibbon. They want to create a statue of Constantine. And this was supposed to be a huge, grandiose equestrian statue. And they didn't have anyone capable of making it. Mm. The process of decay in the Roman Empire was a decay in every sense. I mean, because of wars and barbarian incursions and so on, and the general instability, you had a decline in towns, therefore a decline in artisan capacities, and skills were lost. And in the end, in order to make this statue, they had to cannibalize another statue of some other Roman emperor and get bits that were were fitted together.
Mm.
And this has not happened in capitalism. On the contrary, you know, the development of technique, the development of science and also of technique has gone on apace. You know, it's, going back to the Chinese shoe factory, They reduced the amount of time between getting in orders for a new make of shoe and producing the shoe to a matter of weeks, if I remember rightly, which means rejigging everything and so on. And the amount of time it takes to produce a batch of shoes has been reduced incredibly. But to what end? Well, the shoes are garbage. Everybody knows that you go to buy shoes today and you're spending phenomenal sums of money for shoes that are completely worthless. They fall apart in a matter of, you buy a shoe that lasts for a year, you reckon you're doing well. All the stuff with it. The only thing you can see about it is it's got Nike labels. And
the huge ecological...
Yes, exactly.
The ecological shipping them across the world.
Colossal.
Yeah.
And also getting rid of them. Because what happens to these things when they come apart, which is generally what happens, where you throw them in the bin. Mm. And there is now a problem of pollution as a result of clothing being thrown away. Again, it's a movement even in our lifetime. I remember when I was a kid, you didn't throw clothes away. You patched them or mended them and then you used them as dusters.
Darned your socks.
Yeah, I never darned my socks. I have to go for this. I never darned my socks. My grandmother made all my grandfather's socks. So. We come from a generation whose parents went through the war and went through ferocious austerity. So, again, you took care of things, you saved things. Nowadays, no, this has all disappeared because the clothes cost far less. But then they don't last. And there's an enormous propaganda machine keeping telling you that you have to replace them, you have to replace them, you have to replace them. So you end up with landfills full of T-shirts,
that are not biodegradable either.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So there's a whole industrial process which is still going. And yet, to what purpose?
Well, this connects to another, which we touched on already, the critique, so-called, of decadence, the idea of it's a objectivist. That it creates objective laws, which it's based on the idea that there are objective laws which only have to sort of work themselves out at some point. Perhaps the working class has to intervene, but very often the idea is that with this view, all you need is a kind of vanguard party to kind of lead the workers at the crucial moment to take over the means of production or whatever.
And the vanguard party appears as a kind of deus ex machina at some suitable moment when all of a sudden there's a blinding light and the workers are aware of the...
Yes. And I mean, this can be seen as usually a negative, like the vanguard party, bad thing, so we don't like the objectivist view. I mean, this was already being put forward by Paul Cardin in the early 60s, his views about how the objectivist view, which he accused Marx himself of having... sort of automatically leads the view of the vanguard party sort of intervening at the crucial moment and leading us to the promised land. And therefore the subjective element of development of consciousness in the working class is negated by this idea. And what strikes me as essential to this view of things is an acceptance, really, of the economy as something which is separate from human activity. But the problem is that it's a product of alienated activity. And the concept of alienation, which is obviously central to Marx, is absolutely central to the critique of political economy.
Mm.
The whole idea of the commodity is something which, by its very nature, escapes the control of the producer and of capital, which becomes a force... posed against the producer, is fundamental to this idea that we've created this capitalist economy. Human beings have created it. It isn't created by some sort of objective process of the development of productive forces separate from human activity, but it's alienated activity. It's activity which stands against us as an alien force, and the laws of capitalism which work themselves out, they do take on their own dynamic. That is the problem. That is precisely the problem of the system. We've created a system which seems to function, of its own accord, but ultimately it's human labour that's produced it, but it's escaped the control of human labour. And therefore, by its very nature, it's sort of leading us to more and more unforeseen circumstances. And it's the whole essence of the communist revolution is to, as Marx puts it, take back our social...